Hello and welcome to the Nature Snowdonia Outdoor Lives podcast. My name is Mike Crane, author of Nature Snowdonia. This podcast is free to air, ad-free and music-free. You can find out more about me and my workshops and e-learning modules at mikecrane.co.uk. My guest today is Ned Feasey. Ned works for the National Trust in North Wales and he's currently the area ranger for the Carnedite and the Glitherite, and he's working on several projects in that area that I think will be of interest to us. Ned has also been part of the National Trust footpath team. In fact, he got the footpath team going again in about 2017. So he's a man to talk to about footpath and access across Northern Snowdonia, and that's what we'll try and do today in this interview. So, in his spare time, he actually runs his own little farm with his wife, Tilary Fielden, who we interviewed a couple of years ago, and they're trying to model nature-friendly farming in a small farm in Snowdonia. So, you know, before we go any further, you can safely assume Ned is a busy man. So, Ned, first of all, thank you for finding the time to talk to us today. And how are you today? What have you been doing today, actually?
Well, thank you for inviting me on. It feels a bit strange sort of speaking on these. I've listened to a few of your podcasts.
Here you are live.
Jobs here and there, so it'll be funny me appearing on one. Not too bad, thanks. Been busy today, sort of feeding and battling the frozen pipes. It's been sort of -5, -6 here the last couple of mornings, so all the water, apart from the house itself, is frozen solid.
Wow. I just can't imagine how hard it is. So today's been a day on your farm.
Yeah.
So how many days a week do you work for the National Trust?
I'm now down to 3 days a week.
Oh, that's
Monday to Wednesday, which is a much easier balance between trying to farm in my spare time and the weekends. So I get 4 days working for free on the farm and then 3 paid days work at the National Trust in Ocwen.
I don't know how you do it. Let's start with the trust job though. What is an area ranger and what do you do?
So an area ranger, the way the trust is structured normally is for each estate or patch. So the one that I work on is the Gliderai and Carnedai estate, which is, as it sort of says, most of the Ocwen Valley, either side of the road, the whole of the Carnedai estate. They tend to be managed in a way you have a lead ranger who sort of runs the show to a certain extent.
Yep.
And then a couple of area rangers who have certain projects or tasks that they help out with. Mm-hmm. And then a normal ranger who works underneath them.
Okay.
I'm one of two area rangers on the Carnedai estate, and I specialise or I concentrate on the Carnedai partnership work, which is a sort of multi-organisation project that started just before COVID, works across the whole of the Carnedai range, is funded by loads of different quite complicated streams, but mainly the National Trust, the National Park, Natural Resources Wales, the Welsh Government, and then of course the Heritage Lottery Fund. They've all come together to try and do loads and loads of different project strands, if you like, focused on the Carnedai and the surrounding land.
So what strands are you working on, Ned? What are you responsible for, though?
I have to try and remember all these now. So a lot of it's access work, like what I did previously with the Trust. So trying to improve paths that are there already and join them up in a slightly more straightforward way to create what will hopefully, by the end of it, be a more or less continuous circular all the way around the Carnedai.
Oh wow, good.
But I'm only focusing on the bits on the trust land, which, if you think about the northern end of the Carnedai, is Abergwyn Grecin.
Oh yeah.
You then come down to the top of Bethesda, Llanllechyd, Moelfaban, Moelunion that way.
Yeah.
You then come round up the Nant Ffrancon, Braich, Melin, Penrhyl Owen, and so on.
There's quite a lot of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big catch.
Yeah. So when you're building that footpath across the trust land, ideally to go right the way around the Carnedai, I know it's not that simple, but does that mean you're building a path like the one that goes through Nantigiolch from Capelcurig to Cravnant, or is it the stone pitch paths that I know you're working on from... There's a noise in the background, folks, don't worry, it's Ted's fire, we're in the cottage here, and the strange noises are coming from the fire burning. The nice stone pitch path, and you're working on one, aren't you, from Glandina up into that's Cumchloer, isn't it, where that's going. So is it a mix of paths or is it all going to be sort of motorway type type paths?
So this is a very light touch approach. So it'll be looking at paths that are already there,
Yep.
Slightly upgrading or tweaking them, mm-hmm. it's not going to be a bulldozing through a 1.5 to 2 metre wide aggregate path. This is very, very much light touch work.
Yes.
So the idea is that it will visually take its place in the landscape and allow people to use the landscape or facilitate their use without trashing it, basically.
Yeah.
Like the previous work I've done with the trust, that will mainly comprise of stone pitching or steps where it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going through really wet, boggy, especially peaty places, stepping stones.
Yep.
So then that allows the sort of land around to behave as it wants to anyway. The water can move through between the stepping stones.
Yeah.
The odd bridge, which will either be with slates or big slabs that we can source nearby.
Yeah. So who decides then how manufactured the path is? Is it down to your judgment, or do you have to have a committee meeting? And do you have to talk to lots of different people, or do you just know what fits from experience?
It's a bit of everything, really. It's a bit of, from our experience. So in the Trust, we're lucky we've had people who've worked on footpaths for 15 plus years, and just from their own hill walking or mountaineering stuff, they know what works from the feedback we get from the public while we're doing it, which is really important. We don't want to ever be too heavy-handed with something. It has to take its place nicely.
Yeah.
And it also has to be okay for the people who farm or work the landscape.
Yeah.
Because often this stuff is, you know, going through tenanted land or it's on common land. So it has to be okay with how they use the land as well.
It being their interest to have a clearly marked footpath so that people stay on the footpath more, surely.
Yeah, on the whole it is, yeah.
So the tenants to be really supportive of the work you're doing.
Generally, yeah. On the whole, obviously, there's some things don't always go to plan, or people aren't always in agreement. But on the whole, people are, supportive of keeping people more concentrated, so they're not then wandering and going across fences and so on.
And you've worked on footpaths for quite a long time. I believe there are standards to which you have to build footpaths to, aren't there? Or you choose to build footpaths to, is that right?
So you've probably encountered some of the old style, which we try to now avoid. A good example, if you know the west face of Tryfan, just off the A5.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Three car parks.
Yeah.
The big rectangular one where you pull right off the road.
Yeah.
You know that first bit,
which is quite steep,
and all the stones are at the same slope or aspect of the actual land beneath them.
Yeah.
It's not cut in at all.
Yeah.
That's really difficult to walk on, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we try and avoid that sort of thing. And we try and put in steps or stones that are pitched slightly sloping downhill, ever so slightly, to shed water and don't ice up too much.
Yeah.
But otherwise quite flat. Without a huge hike between each one.
Yeah.
So it looks almost like a random sort of assortment of stones.
Yeah.
And then of course we try and pick stuff that is in keeping or as close as we can to the geology of the site.
Because you're not allowed to use the stones on site, are you? They have to be brought in.
No, so often places like Cwmithwell, I know you know Cwmithwell really well. The conservation designation, like SSSI, SAC, the geology can play a really important part of that. And so for a linear metre of pitched path, you're looking at around about a ton of stone.
Wow.
So if you can imagine we pinched a ton of stone from the surrounding area, you'd have this corridor either side of the path there.
Ton of stone per metre?
Thereabouts, with all the little bits and bobs to chop and, you know, pin it tight and stuff.
That's massive. So where do you get the stones from?
It's a mix. We try and get it from farmers who've got some that they've cleared the fields sort of historically. We do buy some in from quarries that have been sort of okayed for use. In Nant Gwynant, actually, because the number of hydropower pipelines have gone in, we've used the stones that have been dug up from the same mountain.
We've
picked the nice ones and then we've taken them back up by helicopter.
And you get enough stones from all these sources for what you need?
We're starting to run out again now, but we have been able to keep up.
That's
but
interesting.
The standard we try and follow is what's called the Scottish National Heritage one.
Oh yeah.
There's a great big PDF online about how to build a path that people will want to sort of subconsciously stick to.
Yeah.
Because no one goes out and says, "Oh, I'm going to go and cause some erosion today." They want to walk side by side, or they're looking up or ahead, and then they just, you know, subconsciously meander or veer off the path. So it's for you to landscape it and use sort of visual blocks or boulders and things to keep them on it naturally.
Yeah, it makes sense. So people want to walk on it rather than want to walk around it.
Yeah, exactly. But it has to facilitate that footfall.
Yeah.
And last, because it's incredibly expensive work.
Well, I can say, because how do you get the stones from wherever you find them to where you need them?
Helicopter.
So that must be a big effort.
Yeah, it's incredibly expensive. So a linear meter upland path, somewhere like halfway up Cummeatbowl towards Tush the Devil's Kitchen,
yeah,
looking at about £185-190 per meter.
Per meter.
Yeah. And that includes stone, helicopter, labour. Yeah. Thereabouts. It's probably gone up now with the price of everything increasing.
Yeah. And where does that money come from? Presumably, if these are public rights of way, the government has a responsibility to pay for them, like they would for a road or something like that?
No.
No?
No. No. It's all... our work is either funded by the public donating.
Yeah.
Through sort of private donations in sort of wills and so on, wow, that sort of thing. But a lot of the Snowdonia appeal and the Snowdonia footpath appeal, which kickstarted our footpath team, was just people like, you know, you. Yeah. Giving a five or ten here and there. Yeah. It goes a long way.
Yeah, maybe we'll switch to do building roads like that one day. That would be progress, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So are there some particular paths you're working on at the moment? I mentioned the one up to Cumslower from Glendina. That's sort of, is that half done? Is that a job
that,
in...
That one... so I've now, the last sort of 6 months, I've moved on from footpath team to another job, which maybe we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
But last summer of 2021, we were up for Nonlloer from Glendenna, up towards the lake at the top there, above the mountain wall. That was one of three paths we concentrated on that year.
Oh, yeah.
That one's had a pretty good hit. It was part of the Cambrian Way, which I don't know if you know much about. It goes all the way from north to south Wales, linking up some really spectacular
routes. Over the tops, isn't it?
Yeah, they've been amazing in helping us financially some of the work. So that was one of the reasons we concentrated on that one.
So it comes down Cwmtriven, doesn't it? Is that right? Or from Bochlwyd?
It goes Bochlwyd, over the Gwydeirau then, and then over to Penapas, and up that way.
Very good. And the bit of Glendina, is that finished now, that path of those as well?
We've done the boggiest bits, sort of halfway up, and then we've done a few sections above the mountain wall towards Llynllwyr. We'll probably leave it a couple more years and see where people tread the line in.
Yeah.
And then you follow where they're wanting to be heading between the sections that you've gone.
It's quite split down the bottom, isn't it?
Yeah. Open up.
Never quite sure which way to go in that area.
But I can't take the credit for that because the four on the team now that are doing it without me are doing most of that work.
So. Great. So what are you doing now, Ned, then? You're not involved directly building the footpath. So are you behind a desk now? Are you an office man?
Yeah, more or less behind a desk.
Yeah, doing what?
So I'm working on the Canedai Partnership Project, which is this great big sort of multi-faceted
we mentioned
project.
That, didn't we? So what's your involvement in that? What do you do with that?
So it's quite a few things. It's the access work, like I was talking about.
Yeah.
It's mainly putting things out to contract with that kind of thing. There's a huge amount of work involving tree planting. So that's either planting for better habitat connectivity.
Yeah.
So it's looking at patches of trees or scrub that are there already and trying to join them up a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's riparian planting along sort of river corridors and so on. And that's mainly focusing this year, certainly, in the Nant Ffrancon Valley and then up into the Benglog and Ogwen as well.
Trying to make a corridor through that, presumably.
Ultimately, it's just trying to get more trees and more sort of structural diversity of habitats into the uplands.
And there's a bit of a discussion, isn't there, about planting trees and natural regeneration. Is that something you have to consider when you're developing these schemes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of these landscapes have, you know, been managed or grazed for so long, there's not always that seed source to allow the natural regen to kick in.
Yeah.
So, given what's going on, you know, with like the carbon crisis and biodiversity crisis, it's kind of viewed often that you want to give it a little bit of a steer, a little bit of a push to help that process.
We've seen new fences down Nant Benglog. Is that the same pattern right through the Nant Ffrancon and trying to get that riparian?
Yeah. Whereabouts are you thinking now? By the A5?
You can see from the A5. The fence has been recently done, hasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, so the one on the left, as you're coming from Capel,
that's
not anything to do with what I'm part of, but on the right, when you're on that straight before Llyn Ogwen, that sort of thing's more National Trust related.
Okay, but presumably it's all the same sort of thing, it's to get more trees in the landscape.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. And then going up the hill, are there places, you know, up to the mountain wall and beyond the mountain wall where you're doing tree planting as well?
So yeah, this winter we're focusing mainly on the Nant Ffrancon and just next to Llynllwyr, like we talked about earlier with the footpaths. of course, you have to work with National Trust tenants
mm-hmm.
who either farm the land, that and the farm itself and the farm house is owned by the trust, and it's on a long-term tenancy or a medium-term tenancy, or the mountain land is owned by the trust. So yeah, we are trying to plant more trees higher up. And that's quite cool, actually, because a lot of it's either... Some of it's planting in cages,
mm-hmm.
because there's just too much livestock pressure, the tree wouldn't be able to last mm-hmm. on its own. Or it's doing sabre planting, which I don't know if you've heard of.
I have, but just for the listeners, what is sabre planting?
It's when you try and select a sapling or a whip that's about 1.2, 1.5 metres tall, and you pick a really steep, rocky place, or protected place from sheep and cattle that are nibbling it, try and use some form of like a natural screen, like maybe some, I don't know, some bracken or some mm-hmm. gorse or something, stick it in there at a right angle to the slope, so it's perpendicular to the slope, so the animal can't reach over to nibble the leader.
That's brilliant.
Kind of works.
Yeah.
If you do it properly, it works very well.
Yeah.
And then it will grow out looking for light like a sabre, have that sweep to it.
Fantastic. And these are in sort of cloughs and valleys, are they up on the hill?
Yeah. The sabre planting works really well along sort of gullies and streams and where you've got that broken land, you know.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant.
But yeah, working with a tenant next to in Ffynnon Lloer and below, who's really supportive and
he's
a really good guy, so we're doing scattered planting there.
Talathlin Ogwen,
isn't it? That's right.
And then beyond there, there's obviously still loads of grazed land, isn't there? Mm-hmm. But you manage the time of year where the sheep can be on the hill, don't you? Is that something that you're involved with as well?
I'm not so much involved with that. That normally comes down to the agri-environment scheme that they're part of.
Oh, I see.
At the moment, that's called Gwastir. So that's like the sort of extra support that a farmer gets for doing things that are environmentally positive. And normally there's a rule with that where you need to take your sheep down by the end of October. Well, it can be the end of October or it can be October. And then not until April.
Yeah.
So it gives the uplands a rest, really.
And then on the top, there's some quite special places on the top of the corner there where you've got the dwarf willow and that sort of thing. And I know... Dr. Barbara Jones was talking about fencing areas off on the top for a while, just to give those places a chance to regenerate. Is that anything you're involved with as well?
It's not actually something that I'm involved with yet. I think it will be on the cards in the coming months. But I'm by no means a specialist on like montane heath habitats or anything like that, so it's something I need to learn more about. But yeah, there has been discussion of fences or putting some small or medium-sized metal cages up there.
Oh, yeah.
Just to see what the difference in grazing pressure is, really.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, wouldn't it? Because there's not just sheep grazing up there, are there? There's ponies as well. So do the National Trust get involved with managing the ponies?
The ponies tend to be managed by the commoners groups. Each common will normally or often have a medal association or a pony association. Mm-hmm. Each farm will have a certain number of ponies that they're responsible for and then manage them. So they will gather them, I'm not sure how many times a year they gather them, it's once or twice, and they'll do a sort of health check, make sure there's nothing untoward happening.
That's great.
They do it very well at Apergwyn Grecin.
Yeah.
The commoners there, really on top of it.
They're really keen, aren't they? Well, I think people like to see the ponies.
Oh, they're additions to the landscape, aren't they? Beautiful
special,
things.
Special. What else is going on the Carnarvon at the moment that listeners might be interested in?
So we're also doing... quite a lot of hay meadow management. So that's mainly working with tenants. It's mainly for bird species, especially the twite population, which is in real decline at the moment. So it's been identified that there's a real lack of a late summer autumn seed source or food source for them. So we're trying to leave more standing grass later in the year. If we are going to cut it much later as hay,
right,
to encourage that diversity and other things to set seed and so on.
Twite's a little brown bird, isn't it? But it's quite rare, isn't it? There aren't many around.
I don't know a huge amount about them.
No.
They're very hard to spot. They're tiny, and they're not that exciting to look at.
No, but they're special to the birders. Anything else?
There's loads of stuff going on. There's a lot of work with archaeology.
Oh, yeah.
So a big part of the project is the Carnarvon is one of the richest sort of mountain ranges and areas, if you like, of archaeology that the Trust has. There's everything going back from sort of Bronze Age burial cairns to medieval enclosures and so on, all the way up to more recent sheepfolds and stuff. So a lot of the work then is uncovering them and keeping them visible.
Uncovering them from what?
Mainly it's gorse.
Oh, yeah.
Gorse and soft brush and so on. So it's mechanically or by hand clearing stuff away just to allow people to enjoy them.
And how do you keep that clear?
It's initially done by either strimmer or with loppers close up.
Yeah.
And there's a woman I work with called Lady Turner, who's fantastic at managing volunteers doing lots of this work.
Yeah.
She works for the Snowdonian Society.
Oh, I know,
so if anyone wants to get involved, there's several volunteer days. The gorse cutting or tree planting.
Yeah. But then the gorse will grow back, surely.
It will grow back, but if you cut it back, it then tends to allow animals into graze, so it'll have more pressure on that piece of land.
So you get some sheep in there. Because gorse is also quite good for planting trees, isn't it? It's a good tree protector.
Yeah, they're a little bit odds, those two ones, those two project strands, if you like, because one is trying to encourage trees off of planting them in gorse, and the other one is cutting around the monuments, but we're trying to make it work alongside each other.
You need a patchwork quilt, don't you?
Absolutely. It's that mosaic habitat that you want.
What else is happening in the corner, though?
There's a lot of other work that I'm not involved with, trying to get communities out and about. School groups, volunteer groups, doing various things.
Yeah.
There's also a push by another member of staff to record the sort of spoken history of the place.
Yeah.
Or the area. If you think about a lot of these, you know, farmers or have been there for generations and generations, they know how things are done. Little stories about features of the landscape.
Yeah.
You know, maybe like rocky outcrop, a scree, a little gully, a story that goes with that. We're trying to get that down and recorded, which is really cool to get to know it more.
So what's good about it? What are you enjoying about working on the corner though? What's special?
Busyness, I guess.
Yeah.
I like working with... It's different working with contractors as opposed to the same team of three others that I used to work with for 5 years.
Yeah.
Or 4 or 5 years. As much as I got on with them really well, it's quite nice having that variety.
Definitely, yeah.
Doing this, that and everything, really.
Does that bring new challenges, though? Different?
Yeah. It's trying to do things in a way where you're working with the tenant or, if it's a grazier, to do things to sort of bring them on board. Because I'm a trust tenant myself, and you had our farm for 2 years, but you never want to go onto someone's land and be heavy-handed, like, this is our idea and this is how it's going to be. You want to try and bring people with you and, you know, get buy-in and get real involvement, if you like, because that's how you get something from it. And often you'll then learn more about that landscape and the stories behind it and how it's been managed and why and so on, and you just get so much more from the whole thing like that.
Yeah, that must be fascinating, because some of these families have been on these farms for a long time, haven't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
And they know the land intimately.
Oh, yeah, hugely, hugely.
Yeah, really interesting, that.
And they can read it so much better than I can.
Yeah.
So it's good to have that input.
Yeah, so the trust tries really hard to work with the tenants. Does the trust have other competing interests, if you like? You know, say people say, no, there should be more trees up here, there should be fewer sheep up here. And does the trust have to manage that sort of combative situation, really?
Yeah, there are certainly always trade-offs to be made.
Yeah.
Because you've got, well, certainly the direction of travel at the moment within a lot of organisations is wanting to plant more trees, especially in the uplands.
Yeah.
And the tenants may be wanting to go slightly towards a heavier stocked, more, not just lucrative then, but an easy way to manage the land, because trees aren't always easy to manage.
Mm.
If you're gathering a mountain of sheep and you've got clusters where sheep can hide or they can get the better of you and cut back around, they can be a right pain. So you've got to try and balance those two competing demands.
Yeah, they're amazing, sheep, aren't they? But I mean, sheep do like trees, don't they? They do shade under them and shelter under them, don't they? So they're not bad for shade trees, are they?
No, I think a part of it is also people often have worked for so many generations to improve land.
Yeah.
You know, to take scrub away. And because trees are seen as further down that succession, it can be viewed as a step backwards, maybe.
Yeah.
Which I completely sympathise with.
Yeah.
Because working land is not, it's not an easy job, and it's often quite thankless.
Do you find, because you have your own farm and you can speak the same language as the farmers? I don't mean that in the Welsh language sense. I mean just you're on the same wavelength as the farmers, because you're doing it yourself, aren't you?
I try to. I mean, I'm only new to it. I've only been farming for 2 or 3 years, really, so probably quite naive still, making all those mistakes.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah. So you must ask them for advice as well.
Oh, it's interesting to see people's systems and try and just ask about how they do it.
Yeah.
And especially if they've been there 3, 4 generations,
yeah,
there'll be a reason why they do things, because they've tried other things and they haven't worked, and you know, that flock has adapted to that landscape, that herd of cattle has.
Wow.
So trying to learn from that's quite cool.
It is, isn't it? So how do you come to be doing it, Ned? How do you, you know, did you go to the careers library at school and say, I want to work for the National Trust, I want to be a ranger? You know, how do you end up being a National Trust ranger for the Carnelli?
I actually did, when I was 14 or 15 at secondary school, I did work experience with the National Trust in Crevel in Bethgelert.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I remember doing a lot of rhododendron clearance.
Yeah.
Just thinking, stuff that for a job.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I did... I was just finishing an MSc at Manchester Uni.
Oh, yeah.
And I moved back home to write up the final project and so on, and saw a summer job at the Trust, like just a seasonal fixed term one. I thought, oh, that'll be great, until I moved back to Manchester or I moved to London or something. And I just never really moved away.
Wow.
Just ended up staying here.
So did you dream of being an urbanite in Manchester or London?
I did it for 4 years in Manchester. I enjoyed it, but I was probably never really going to stay for very long.
No.
It didn't really... Yeah. It didn't make me happy, really.
No.
Not the same way that being back in Eddie does.
Yeah. Because where we are now is a beautiful cottage. It's incredibly quiet and invisible, isn't it, from the outside world? It's a fantastic... Oh, well, I think it's a fantastic place. I think you think it's a fantastic place. But I suspect there's quite a lot of problems with living where you do live here.
Yeah, I love it here. Where we are near Nantymod, it's secluded. We're down a mile dead-end track, so... Mm. If I'm in the Ogwen Valley all day and it's busy, come back here and it's just no one.
That's remarkable.
Dogs, which is pretty special.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's not without its challenges. It's a lowland farm. It's on the old estuary.
It's a lowland farm, but it has characteristics of an upland farm, doesn't it? When you think of a lowland farm, we might think of wheat fields in East Anglia or something. It's not that. It's not a potato farm, is it?
No.
It's got rough land.
It's got deep, sandy, silty fields because it used to be the old estuary,
yeah,
but it floods,
yeah,
and it's very wet in the winter,
yeah.
And then you've got, it borders on the Hafod Gregog and Coed Hafod Llyn nature reserves,
mm-hmm.
So you've got the sort of scrubbiness of them, if you like.
So if that is, if the soil next to the river is alluvium from the river, is that not fertile soil? Is that not good for growing crops?
Yeah, it's reasonably fertile soil, but because it's so sandy, it doesn't hold nutrients very well.
Interesting.
So the ability for it to hold the goodness that you want to grow things or grow good grass from is very poor.
Yeah.
So you need to find a way of balancing that out in a way.
So is the main crop pasture?
Yeah, it's all pasture.
All pasture.
Although the previous tenants grew a lot of veg.
Yeah.
Really good carrots here because of the deep sand.
Well, say, you know, I can buy meat from yourselves. You know, we can buy meat. We know where to get meat in Snowdonia, but it's quite hard to get veg. Is it just harder work producing veggies? It all has to...
I've never really tried. I'm not skilled enough, but yeah, I think it's really labour intensive.
Yeah.
There's an amazing place near Pantglas called Henbant. Yeah. We get our veg from them.
Yeah.
Really good veg books.
Seems more difficult to do. So what are you doing on this farm then, Ned? What are you producing here?
So it's beef and sheep. The main farm here is 115 acres, so it's sort of smallish.
Yeah.
And we've probably got another touching 200-ish elsewhere, all around Nantymod, Bethgelert, and some near Maen Twrog. We're trying to do things in quite an old-fashioned way, really. So we're trying to farm as much as we can for nature, both because we think it having a low input system is more profitable for us,
mm-hmm.
and we think that if you use animals in the right way, it can be really beneficial for wildlife and for nature. So we're trying to do things like leaving a lot of the farm to go to flower,
mm-hmm.
and set seed, and if we were to take a hay or a silage or haylage cut, we'll do it later in the year once it's sort of given or benefited nature in some way. We're doing lots of other stuff by trying to put cows up in sort of heathland or uplands to break up. You often see like that sort of monoculture millennia.
Yeah.
Sort of smothers and thatches and
purple moor grass, tussock grass is commonly known as, So cattle will break that up, will they?
They will do, yeah. If you time it right and rest it properly, they seem to, yeah.
Mm.
We're learning with that one still. And then we try and do a lot of introducing cows into woodlands that haven't previously been grazed.
Oh, yeah.
So either for ourselves or on a sort of conservation grazing basis where we get paid to or we get asked to.
Yeah.
That one's a little trickier because although I think cows would be classed as a woodland animal or happy in the woodland, yeah. they don't always thrive there. There's not always enough good stuff going through them.
Right.
So the management of that's a little bit trickier. Needs to balance it.
Needs a bit of a mix and match there, doesn't it? Let's just unpick that a bit then. So this idea of nature-friendly farming, isn't it? This is somewhere in between the sort of rewilding ideal concepts and intensive farming, which we've seen quite a lot of. Where does it come from, nature-friendly farming? Does it come from a realisation that, you know, we just need to do more for nature and farmers are in a position to do that? Or are farmers sort of been pushed to do it? You know, you said, no, you've got to be more nature-friendly. You know, where does the drive come from initially?
I'd say with how things are at the moment, it's more of a grassroots-based approach. It's people going, the current input-based or more sort of mechanised approach to farming isn't really working and they don't necessarily agree with it.
Yeah.
So nature-friendly farming, well, to me, certainly is trying to work within natural systems, mimic them, but in a way that is within the sort of parameters of your own farm, which will benefit nature, the soil, give off wider benefits and services like clean water, storing carbon and so on, whilst also producing food. So it's trying to mimic those natural processes in a more controlled way. So one of the big things we do here with that is moving, especially cattle, very quickly through the landscape, like they would do before we came here and changed everything. Yeah. So you might have a big, big herd of auroch or similar.
Yeah.
They would be moving through a landscape very fast because they were being predated upon.
Yeah.
And then grazing incredibly hard, wasting a lot of grass, pushing it back into the soil to build organic matter, and then resting it for 100, 150 days.
Wow.
Come up again.
That's amazing, that. And that produces a good beef.
It seems to, yeah.
That commands a premium.
Yeah.
Does it pay its way, or are you reliant on farm support payments from the government to achieve those nature outcomes?
That's a good one. We sell all the beef and lamb direct to consumer, so we do it through lamb or beef boxes around the Uri. We deliver, and we do some courier around the UK. Although we ask for a good price for our meat, it doesn't pay for itself without support. But because of what went on with Brexit, we are farming with the basic level of financial support in place, which is like a throwback from the European stuff, but we haven't got that added glass tier, which is what I was talking about earlier, that agri-environment scheme that pays farmers to do the extra bit for nature. And that is completely the difference in our system between profit and loss.
Because currently we're between schemes, aren't we? We've come out of the European Union, so we're not in the European Union schemes. And the scheme that was in place then is the one that's continuing. And the new, in England, it's ELMS, isn't it? Environmental Land Management System. It's a different scheme in Wales, but it's still not there in Wales, is it? Why isn't it there yet? You know, we've been out for yonks. Well, you know, what are they dragging the feet out?
It's under consultation. I don't know how many you've had now, is it three? They're still designing it. I think it's going into the more modelling phase at the moment. Teledi will know more about this than me.
Must be so frustrating, though.
It is, but it sharpens what you're doing, really, because if you were in a glass tier contract already, you would have it rolled on or extended year on year.
Yeah.
We haven't got that, and we just have to behave like we're not going to have it because we don't know when we are going to get any more support.
Yeah.
So you have to try and farm in a way that is as cheap in terms of inputs as possible, and try and use the land in another way, really.
I think it's really hard for people to get their heads around. I mean, if you take a sheep, it's that's not really very profitable either, is it? Yeah, if I go to the butcher to buy lamb, it's quite expensive.
Cheaper, if anyone, because they're a real efficient converter of pretty poor agricultural land into good quality protein. So I don't know, I'd argue that it probably is worth the money being spent, because a lot of husbandry, a lot of care consideration, managing that flock, taking down over the winter, paying for their wintering elsewhere, goes into
No, I mean, it's the economic model. I can see the inputs that you have in a sheep, the time you spend with it, regardless of all the other stuff. So if you're keeping a sheep for a year, that costs you quite a lot of money. But the return on it, does the return on it that you get from the wholesale butcher cover the cost of that?
It For the sheep, it's slightly better because they're cheaper over the winter. It does, but not by much.
No.
It will cover its cost just.
Yeah.
But if you want to start thinking about taking a wage off it,
yeah,
you know, you're joking.
It's really hard, isn't it?
It is tough, yeah.
I don't understand why we've got to this situation whereby, you know, we're putting farmers under such a stress because they're not getting enough money for the stuff they're producing.
Yeah, that's one of the main reasons behind us, especially Tulare being so good at it, wanting to sell the meat direct.
Yeah.
Because you're not open then to the market volatility that happens if you're selling it through the markets or through other things.
Why don't more farmers do that? But if more farmers did do that, would that affect the price?
I think more and more are doing it.
Yeah.
It's easy for us to, because, you know, we're new to it. We've only got 100-ish sheep with followers, yeah. 30 cattle slightly under. We're very sort of manageable, and it's a system which is still being adapted or shaped to what we want to be doing. Mm. If you've got a flock, a hill flock of, say, 300 to 500, mm, shifting all those lambs through boxes is a huge amount of work.
It is an awful lot of work, isn't it, selling? And I know I spoke to one farmer, he said, well, I'm a farmer, I'm not a yeah, shopkeeper, you know, I don't, yeah, know how to do that bit. So it's easier said than done from the
absolutely,
comfort of,
yeah,
a sofa, isn't it? But you've got a customer base now, haven't you? Yours goes quite quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're so lucky. Always, a lot of it goes down to Tulare's hard work of advertising and,
yeah,
letting people know about what we're doing through social, yeah, media and so on,
yeah,
and our sort of principles and ethos. But yeah, we sell out every time within a day or two. Which is great.
It really is. It really is. But you're a proper team here, aren't you, as well?
It's, oh yeah, you've
real,
got to be.
Real teamwork.
Got to be.
And what else are you doing on the farm? I mean, you're trying other ways to.
Yeah, so we're starting to sort of dabble with diversification. So we've got a really beautiful old hay barn, which Tulare and I got married in a year and a half ago. So we sort of cleaned it up and tidied it and so on. And we're just about to put in a bathroom for that to help the diversification side. So if anyone wants to come and hire a venue or something, get in touch.
Yeah, it's a great venue. So we're doing a first aid course there, which is why I'm here today, using the barn for a first aid course. It's a lovely venue, really,
yeah,
good venue. It's been a bit cold today, but I think that's more to do with the weather than Ned and Tulare's business. What successes have you had on the farm so far?
I'd say the real success has been, one, the meat, the quality of the beef for me in particular, because I prefer beef to lamb.
Yeah,
it's just really, really tasty stuff. It's grass fed. You know, we don't feed them grains or things to finish them.
Yeah,
it's just what it can find. Us managing them with an electric fence, and then a lot of the time they've got a huge mountain area, heathland to graze.
Yeah, yeah.
And it takes longer. It takes sort of 3 years thereabouts to,
oh, wow,
get an animal to reach maturity,
yeah,
or to fatten. But it's really tasty beef.
We certainly had a piece of brisket off you recently and just cooked it slowly.
Is that right?
It was absolutely gorgeous. It's just, you don't need to do anything fancy to it.
No.
Just cook it well and it's absolutely beautiful.
No, it's good. That's been really nice. Another thing is, especially sort of that May, June time, if you're allowing this year it was, what, a third of the farm, going on half the farm, we completely shut up and let flower.
Just
walking through that sort of thing, all the flowers. You know, because we're surrounded by woodland either side of the valley, and then you've got what essentially the hay meadows or wildflower,
yeah,
meadows in the middle, the insect life that comes off that, which then feeds the bird life.
Ooh.
It's just a sort of feel-good factor.
It really is an astonishing place. I hesitate to ask about challenges, but of course everyone wants to know what's hard about it, what's, you know, where are the worries, you know, what keeps you awake at night?
Finances are a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't make, you know, enough money for us to, or either of us, to stop working.
Mm.
So I'm 3 days a week, Tulare's 4 days a week, farming in our spare time, really. Climate change, because we're down all the estuary fields away from the house are 3 to 4 metres above sea level.
Yeah.
If we're going to get more flooding in the future and more sort of unpredictable weather,
yeah,
how long will they remain viable?
Yeah.
We don't know. But, you know, it makes it exciting.
Well, it does have a dull moment. So we should just come back. I mean, the main audience for this will be leaders, lowland leaders, hill and moorland leaders, mountaineering instructors. You know, as somebody who works for the National Trust on the Carnedd, the Gliddereye, somebody who runs your own farm in Snowdonia, what is there anything you'd like them to be better at, or anything you'd like them to take particular care about, or know more about, you know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a lot of people see it already as a bit of a playground, which absolutely fantastic because it's spectacular. It's a beautiful place to go walking, exploring, climbing, what have you. But I think also to take an interest in the people and the farming systems that have worked that landscape for so, so long, you know, for centuries and centuries. Not just in the sort of physical way that shows the landscape, like the walls, the sheepfolds and so on, but the way that these people work it, walk it, learn it, and how they interact with it as well.
It's like the people are an important part of that landscape, isn't it?
Hugely, yeah. Hugely.
Certainly here in Wales, that the language sort of resides in that farming community as well, doesn't it? Which is an important attraction, I think, really, because it's the only national part where a different language is the first language, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think a big one as well is, you know, treat it with respect, be involved, and as bad as it sounds, try and spend money here. Because if it's a place where people come, look at, enjoy without interacting and spending, it becomes a sort of theme park. And it is a work, live landscape. So for those two to still be compatible going forward and to have a future, there has to be that economic element.
It's certainly something we've talked about in other arenas. The people who fill up their car at home and get the food from the local supermarket and then visit Snowdonia and camp out wild and then drive home. It's not really playing the game, is it? You know, people do need to chip in a little bit somehow. Because on the other hand, there are people who are critical of tourism because it's not spending money. So the more tourists are seen to contribute to local economy, the better, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think another thing is, in terms of involvement, if there's anything people could do in terms of volunteering or just taking interest like that, the groups that we have had when I was doing footpath work, doing like maintenance runs, you know, clearing drainage channels and so on, the groups we now have doing tree planting, vegetation clearance. Once you sort of have a little bit of involvement yourself, I mean, you've done it, haven't you?
It really just sort of
builds on itself.
So people can volunteer. Is the Snowdonia Society the easiest way to do that?
Yeah, we tend to run everything in partnership with them.
All
manner of volunteering things, from litter picking to tree planting, hedgerow stuff.
And that's a nice thing in Snowdonia, that cooperation between the National Trust, the National Park and the Snowdonia Society to get things done, isn't it? It's a really good good partnership, and you're a key part of that.
Yeah, certainly in the Canada job there's a lot of working in partnership, which isn't always without its challenges, but on the whole, you need to get more done, you've got more momentum and energy behind you.
So what's next? What's for the future? Where do you think things should go in the Carnedd, for example? What will it look like in 5-10 years time?
That's a difficult one. Hopefully the project that I'm involved with will have been a success. It's supposedly got 2 years left on it.
And
money will be well spent in a way that people in the future will be able to benefit from and look back on and say, oh, that was a good thing to have done.
That's
my sort of hope for it, really.
That'd be brilliant.
Well spent that's brought people with it. It's not sort of rub people up the wrong way, and it's got people's involvement.
And we are nudging things towards a more nature-friendly future, aren't we? It is generally becoming more accepted in the farming community as a way.
I think so, yeah. Especially with this more recent push with tree planting.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard, there's as part of the proposed new scheme, each farm will have to have 10% of land as tree cover.
It's had a mixed reception, hasn't it?
It's had a very mixed reception, especially on farms where they don't always have 10% of land to spare. Small or medium sized farms.
And if a farm's already got 10% of trees, do they need to have another 10% of trees?
I don't think so, no.
And if a farm's got less than 10%, it might be a good reason for that.
If it has less than 10%, I think that they then have to find a way of meeting that 10%. But I'm sure there'll be help in doing so. And then I believe on top of that it's 10% of land managed for habitat in some way, so that might be something like a hay meadow or something.
Well, I like all that, but if I was a farmer and I had 20%, does that mean I could clear 10% of my trees?
I don't know.
It seems hard to be fixed in stone that every farm should have 10%, because some farms could have 30% and not change, whereas others it's hard to get to 10%, isn't it?
I don't know how that's going to pan out on the land,
we'll see.
Like landscape scale.
But I mean, the message to listeners is this is important, isn't it? It's part of the landscape. It's part of the places that they are earning their living as well, and they need to engage a little bit more. I mean, one way of engaging is to come on the Down on the Farm workshop and meet Ted and Tulare and see what it's actually like trying to run a farm in Snowdonia.
Yes, we ran a couple with you in the past, the last year, haven't we? They've been a good success. Yeah. It's always nice to have people take an interest.
That's the
biggest thing, you know. Yeah. The questions you get, they're often really sort of sincere and from a good place.
Yeah.
And they can make you think, oh, hang on, why do we do it that way? Or what's the reason for that?
That's wonderful. Well, hey, listen, we've been talking for quite a long time there, Ned. I need to wrap it up now because I need to go home and eat some of your meat. Sorry to any vegans that are listening, but this is beautiful meat that's reared in a very, very gentle way. It's gorgeous. And it even goes for small local abattoir, doesn't it? It's all good stuff.
It only travels 20 minutes up the road to Llanfestiniog.
Yeah.
A small family-run abattoir there called Cayaco, which is fantastic. You know, low stress. Till the last moment.
It's as good as you can get. Hey, is there anything else you'd like to add there before we finish?
I don't think so, no. It's got it all covered.
So, Ned Feasy, Diolch yn Fawr. Nos da, pnawn da. It's good evening.
Nos da. Nos
wyth da. Nos wyth da.